Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming to talk with us. My name is Jennifer McIntyre, and this is Rachel Ford.
Hi.
I've been a public defender at the Snohomish County Public Defender Association for 22 years, and Rachel has for 13 years. So this came about from us just having a lot of conversations about frustrations we had with the criminal justice system and problems we saw, and knowing that we should be bringing this out to the greater community and having discussions rather than just amongst ourselves as public defenders and people who work in that area.
So we'll just go ahead and get started on our presentation then. So we thought about basically where, I think there's a commitment to social justice throughout the Bible, but where we're talking about specifically in this presentation is with the prisoners. And Hebrews just told us to remember the prisoners as if we are in prison, and how they are treated or mistreated as if we're in their place. So the first thing that we really want to draw your attention to is the incarceration rates in the United States as compared to other countries around the world. And these are all NATO countries, as you can see here. But, I mean, we outpace everywhere else in the world with our incarceration rates by many, many, many times over. I can't even do the math in my head. And at the very bottom of this, you'll see Norway, and at the end of our presentation, we're going to do a little bit of a comparative analysis. But we first kind of wanted to start with a discussion, and that is, what values do we hold as a society that have led to mass incarceration? So anyone have any input, or you want to...
Maybe you might want to turn to somebody you're sitting next to and talk about it for a second. We were just sort of interested in how come we are way up here? What is it about the United States that has led to this happening? What about our society has allowed us to have this incarceration rate? What we see as negative, some may see as positive. But
so actually, yeah, just take a couple of minutes and talk to the people around you and come back.
Necessarily, but I think racism is number one.
Racism, okay. Go ahead.
We don't have a very good mental health system here in the United States. There's way too many people with mental health that are in the prisons.
Lack of mental health treatment.
I was thinking too that the Pilgrims were a rather swift, punitive group. So a lot of our foundation in this country, I was thinking back to Massachusetts and the witch hunts, and that was a very, swift, punitive mindset.
So a punitive history in the back?
I think we value, as a society, we sort of value those people who are ambitious and successful and powerful. order to become that way, you have to be pretty, you may have to be ruthless and not care about other people. And also, we can't live the way we live unless other parts of the world are in abject poverty. So it's just sort of a lack of empathy in some ways.
Yeah, or maybe I think what I'm hearing too is sort of this idea that we just pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, that we are responsible, solely responsible for our own behavior. We live in this vacuum where
work hard enough.
Yeah, and doesn't take into account the people's cultural experiences and socioeconomic status.
So I think since we were founded as a place that people could come and have freedom, and that everyone could come to, so we were not as homogenous. But then as people who didn't look like me came, you know, and maybe was afraid of them. So the fact that we started out with a lot of different people from a lot of different areas in the world.
So sort of the opposite of our theme for the week, the fear is what has driven the mass incarceration. Any other? Go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say, knowing that there's a lot of privately run prisons, I think there's a focus on profit and shareholders, capitalism and affiliates.
Feeding the coffers.
Yep.
Sure. The system feeds itself. Yeah, go ahead.
We're a country that has determined that we need to wage war against drugs, including drugs that other countries might not feel are that worthy of incarcerating.
Right, so even the language we use in sort of the crimes that we talk about, we use words like war instead of words of like help.
Yeah.
Okay, all right,
war.
Go ahead.
I think we value comfort as a whole, and that meaning that when we have a problem, we put it away where we don't have to look at it and we don't have to feel our own complicity in the system of why we might be struggling with drug addiction or why our school systems are so broken. And how instead of fixing the problem, we want to feel comfort of not having to deal with the problem, so we put it away.
Not dealing with the causes of the situation.
Hide it away.
Yeah, compartmentalizing maybe.
Denial.
Yeah.
Denial.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Okay. Any other ideas? Go ahead.
Weak and absentee parenting.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
The rich poor gap.
All right. Socioeconomic things. Okay. Yeah. Just better mouth.
Yeah. Lowered education.
Okay. Education problems. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The idea of the concept of personal responsibility, just as a notion.
Yeah.
The belief that if someone does something that we deem wrong, that they're irredeemable.
So people cannot change. We are who we are. Can't teach an old dog new tricks. Anyone else? Okay. I think this. Go ahead. Sorry, what's that? Okay. So one of the things that we should look at when we think about all these things is the different theories of punishment. So we'll kind of go through and explain each one, but the deterrent theory, and you can think about this as individual deterrent or sort of
general
deterrence, but basically the idea that if we make a punishment severe enough, either someone will think in that moment, gosh, I don't want to burgle that home because I might get 5 years or 10 years, or even generally think, I saw my neighbor, you know, get this punishment, and so I don't want to put myself in that situation. So that's sort of one theory that has led, I think, to high prison sentences.
Retribution. If you do something wrong, you're punished, and you deserve it, and we're going to punish you and get retribution for what you did. So that's obviously one of the strong factors in the United States, incarceration rates.
Yeah, it's kind of eye for an eye, right?
Mm-hmm.
The next theory of punishment is the preventative theory, and the idea is if they're locked up, they can't do it. So
you're out of commission.
If you're in jail, you cannot burgle a house. You cannot assault anyone if you're in jail. And that's just sort of let people say, well, let's keep them away for even longer.
That fits for me under racism, where really the policy is to get young black and brown men off the street and keep them off the street till maybe they're 26 or whatever. James
yeah.
P. Wilson, noted policy guy.
Yeah, we're going to be talking a lot about race coming up here. And then we'll,
but definitely the
opposite.
And then reformative theory. The reformative theory is that if somebody goes into a prison, that there will be help for them, that they can get their GED, learn a trade, that while they're away, they can somehow come out a better person, or a person who will no longer do what they did before they went into prison. And in a way, that is the theory that we are really looking towards and looking at the different possibilities that there are out there. Instead of the deterrent, retributive, and preventative theories.
So we are by no means the first people to think about this problem or the most well-versed. Has anyone read this, The New Jim Crow? Okay,
yeah.
Someone want to just fill in everyone else? Any volunteer to give a little synopsis? Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
It draws... it tells a narrative and draws a line between slavery and mass incarceration and the transformation in American society by evolving institutions to sort of fulfill the same purpose as the origins of slavery.
And so this is sort of the origins of what you were talking about with, you know, locking up people of color. If you haven't read it, they can speak much better about this even, you know, than we can today, but... anyone seen this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who wants to tell everyone about this? This is a Netflix series. It came out, I think, last fall, about a year old. Anyone? So it's a lot of the same themes. The 13th Amendment is the amendment that freed the slaves, but it also and gave slaves the right to vote. But it also put in a lot of stipulations, like you can't have any criminal history, or you can't, you know, all the things that we do to suppress the voting rights of people who are of color too, really have their origins in slavery. And the 13th Amendment saying, okay, we're gonna free you, but we're not gonna let you participate in a meaningful way. And then locked in. Let's see. This one. Is another great one, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration. So if you guys, we can repeat these later, but if you are interested in these topics, these are the seminal, I think, current writings and videographic words on this issue. But let's go ahead and continue talking. These are sort of what Jennifer and I have come up with as... See my mouse cursor over there. Okay. What we have identified as the primary drivers of mass incarceration. And the first one is prosecutor charging decisions. And that is basically this idea that discretion lies, or lack of discretion lies, in the hands of some of the most privileged people in our society, most well-educated, and also really young and inexperienced people who don't have a lot of life perspective in many cases. But what we sometimes don't always recognize is that when someone is arrested, the prosecutor does not have to charge that crime. They can make a decision that, you know, this person was perhaps experiencing some mental health symptoms that drove this offense or something like that. And it just really depends on the whim of whoever the case file lands in their lap.
And it's not just charging. Once it's charged, the prosecutor decides what alternatives are open to that person, whether they can go to a mental health court if there's even one available, whether they can do a treatment alternative if there's one available. The prosecutor also, what they can do is they can say, if you don't take this plea, we're going to charge you with 8 other counts. And even if those counts couldn't be proven in court, when we're talking to a client and we say, well, here's the offer, because a defense attorney always has to convey an offer to a client.
even if it's a terrible offer, it's your duty to convey that offer. So we would have to say, well, if you can plead guilty to this one charge, and if you don't, they're going to add, you know, six more counts for the other, you know, items you stole, or for something that they are alleging you did along with this allegation. And that will often lead, it gives them leverage, and it will scare people, and they will often take a plea deal, even if they have a good case. I don't know, John Oliver is always ahead of us a little bit, but he just did something about the power of prosecutors that I would recommend that to anybody to watch. He really explains it very well.
And the next one is, there are some reforms and some of these alternatives, and we're going to talk more about those in a minute. But what often happens is they exclude a series of, like, violent offenses, for example. But the problem is that the definition of violent offense is very broad. And so, you know, someone can be excluded from an alternative simply because there's something called a domestic violence tag. Even if the offense was not violent in any nature, like violating a no contact order or something like that, just by simply having a phone conversation or sending a letter, that is then termed, if it's a crime of domestic violence, termed a violent offense in some situations, and then no alternatives are available to a large number of potential offenders. So next we're actually going to show you a video that was produced by a social worker in our office, and it's about a client that I have or had, and we are playing this with his permission, but this is a tool. This video was made to use to both influence the prosecutors, well, he had been charged, but ultimate charging decision.
Have him amend the charge to a different charge.
And then also this video was used, it was essentially, my client was pulled over for DUI, and then whether it was a result of a misunderstanding because of a language barrier or something else, basically like a tussle ensued, but they were on the side of the freeway where there was a big, deep gully, and so they ended up tumbling down that, and at least one of the officers got pretty significantly injured, and had to be off work for 8 months. But we use this video to influence both of these drivers, so I want to show you that.
Me llamo Pedro Gómez y tengo 45 años. Yo vivo en un bar con mi esposa y con mis hijos. Mi familia es muy importante.
Mi nombre es Modesta Roberto Rubito. Tengo 23 años con Pedro. Siempre ha sido buen papá con sus hijos. Siempre ha estado responsable del hogar. Un buen esposo y trabajador para salir adelante.
I would describe my father as a hardworking man, a funny guy, and really giving, especially with the homeless that we see nowadays, like in almost every corner of the streets. He will stop for all of them. He wouldn't just say, okay, there's another one, let's go. He would just stop and give, even if it was a dollar or whatever he had. I would describe my father as nice, funny, and respectful. A thing I admire about my dad is that he provides me a place to live.
Yo trabajo para Open Road Arlene. Tengo 2 años, y es muy buen trabajo. Y muy buenas personas ahí.
I have known Pedro for approximately 6 years. This is the third location that Pedro has worked from. I have taken that man and his family everywhere I've gone. It's the same reason that the owner of this company here actually worked with Pedro at 2 locations ago where the owner and I worked at. And that was one of his first questions when I came on board here. Can you bring Pedro and his family? And Pedro moved him and his family 70 miles to work up here with me. Pedro's job description is basically the detail manager. He's responsible for making sure that all the coaches on the lot, whether they're inventory or clients' coaches, or sold units are always kept clean. He's also responsible for the fact that all the coaches on the lot have to be in the correct locations. He also operates a forklift to make sure that everything is moved correctly without any damage to the coaches and everything like that.
Every day, and this is parking every day. Sometimes it's too tight, it's a small plane. I like this job, it's pretty good. It's a little much more
than I would describe Pedro as our hardest working employee in this dealership. He's always early, stays late, works overtime when needed, never says no, just always has a smile on his face.
Sometimes Pedro move this inside the shop. Yeah, okay, thank you.
You ask him, can you do me a favor and do this? Piece of cake, 5 minutes. That's Pedro. It can be raining, it can be snowing, it can be sunny, it can be windy, it can be blistering out there. And the man will say, beautiful day, every day.
Beautiful day.
Pedro has 2 family members that work here. One is his son, one is his wife. His wife has also worked for me for the last 6 years. There's a reason why. These 3 people work so well together, it's almost like they each think as one.
Morning, Modesta.
They know what the other person's doing, and they know what the next course of direction is.
César anda limpiando los compartments. Modesta va a limpiar de adentro. Yo voy a subir arriba a lavar el roof. Yes, they work.
When you have the opportunity to work with my mom and dad, it's an atmosphere that's easier than having to work just by yourself. When you have them together, it's everything basically runs smooth. Every task that we do here in our job is well done. It doesn't have issues or anything like that.
I've known Pedro for 6 years. He has followed from company to company to work for us. When I found out that Pedro was coming up here to work with us, I literally cried and gave everybody a hug. Pedro is very dedicated. He always has a smile on his face. When he interacts with the other employee, he lights up the room. He always has a smile. Very easy to work with. He's definitely a team leader, and customers love him.
Every day, microwave, sink, a little stove, mini stove. That's a little house.
Pedro's reactions between his colleagues and him is phenomenal. I've never seen him get in an argument. I've never seen him get in a disagreement. He's always been the first person there to move something or help another technician or another employee or whatever they're doing to make sure that what they were doing was made easier for them. Clients love him to death.
The time I was most impressed with Pedro was after we had a show at the Tacoma Dome. And they are very long and grueling, and you are moving coaches round the clock. And he had been moving coaches for many hours. It was late, and he was clearly exhausted, but he hopped out of it with a smile on his face. And I remember he said to Steve Shriver, the general manager, "What's next, boss?" Pedro and I went to go pick up a coach about 4 years ago. That is when I became aware of Pedro's sense, his humor, his love for his family. He would not shut up the whole time, and he was making me laugh just from stories that he would tell, that Pedro was telling me about his family. Pedro is the backbone of his family. Pedro keeps his family together, and he will do anything. He will take the shirt off his back for his family.
He is so proud of Paulino. Point blank, if he talks about any of his children, Pedro talks about Paulino the most and the fun that they've had.
A really good memory I had with my dad was make a huge snowman. It was bigger than my brother. It was super big. And it didn't melt until 2 weeks, which it was pretty cool. It was so fun to do it with my dad because it took a lot of time just to make it.
When I graduated high school, he was there for me. He was really proud of us. I was the second one of the family to graduate. My sister was the first person to graduate.
I'm currently going to school for accounting, and my dad has always encouraged me to continue and to learn as much as I can to be a better person in life and to actually have a different job from what they have had their entire life and not be outside in the cold. There were times where I would go with them to their job. And actually, I spend the whole day with them there, and I see the whole thing that he does. It's hard labor. It's not the same as some people sitting in an office.
I literally admire Pedro every day. You have no idea what it's like to have an individual that works in the worst department at any company and work outside in this weather. To come in and day out. He'll work 6 or 7 days a week without even saying no. The man has never said no.
Personally, and I know Jim, his boss, will do whatever we need to help facilitate anything that Pedro needs to be successful in court.
If there was something that I could do for Pedro to help him out, whatever had to been to happen to keep him here, I would do.
If Pedro were no longer employed here, it would hugely affect our dealership because he, his wife, and son all work here. And if he no longer worked here, we would lose all three, and it would be a devastating loss for our dealership, as there are only three employees in our detail shop. And we have had many detail employees in the past who were not dependable and had drug issues, attendance issues. We never had any of those issues with Pedro. These people do not miss work. We have never been able to find employees anywhere close to their quality and integrity.
We would have to hire at least 5 people to replace Pedro. He is a workhorse.
Pedro being gone, I don't know how many employees I'm going to go through, because I'm not going to find somebody to replace if they're not out there. Pedro has been, he's dedicated to his family. Because of his dedication to his family, he brings that same type of can-do attitude or personality to work, because he knows if he does the job here, then his family's taken care of.
If my dad leaves, it will impact the weekends that we spend together. I don't really miss it, because we usually go out and hang out and have dinner together.
It would be harder to raise our family having him gone, and my little brother, he wouldn't have his dad in his life, and have him in if he ever was to graduate through high school, he wouldn't have him at that moment.
Todos queremos que no se vaya, ¿verdad? Que quede. Que se quede en su hogar. César pues ya está grande, él ya trabaja y Mayra pues ya también ella es, tiene su hogar diferente, pero más por el chiquito, que él es el que más siente que no es su papá.
Paulino es el más joven, tiene que seguir estudiando para que aprenda bien, para que sea algo Muy bien. Más tarde.
If my dad wasn't here, life would be broken. Life would be harder than usual. Because we would have a good place to live and like
subtext here. I don't know. It's not like to make it a trick question, but did anyone recognize what else was possibly going on with Pedro and his family? So sort of the subtext we couldn't quite talk
illegal?
About. Right. So Pedro is an illegal immigrant, and so one of the issues that we had prevent not only incarceration is that if he was convicted of the offenses as charged, or if he even spent one more day in jail, he would other than the day he was arrested, he would have been automatically deportable. And when we think about this who we're working to prevent mass incarceration for, you know, I think sometimes it's hard for us to think about we're doing this for people who aren't actually citizens of our country. But when we think about kind of the rhetoric of, oh, we want to get rid of the lazy, you know, Mexicans and all that kind of stuff, I mean, this is Pedro. He's anything but lazy. And this family is anything but dysfunctional. They are so, so very supportive of each other.
And this video actually was successful. This is one where Rachel and our social worker, Heather Manley, were able to send this to the prosecutor with, like, let's hope this works. And the prosecutor wrote back and was like, I'm all in. I agree with you. You know, let's amend the charge and he's not.
It easily could have gone another way, a different prosecutor, a different day, you know.
Super random.
Yeah, it is really arbitrary. So,
and I just want to say, our office has just started doing some of these, we call them social bio videos. We've done about four now. And as you can see, they take a long time. And we're working on it. We're working on editing.
A lot of money.
Pardon me?
A lot of money.
It's just our in-house social worker who's doing it because she loves to do it. And believe me, she's not paid very much money, unfortunately. Not anywhere near what she's worth. But we've done four, and this is the only one right now that has been successful in changing the mind of the prosecutor. We do some of them to change the prosecutor's mind, some of them to try to influence the judge's mind. There was one that we did that did not change the judge's mind. It was a very sad situation where there was a gun that went off and a boyfriend killed a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And it was terrible. He didn't really even want us to do this bio, but his attorney really wanted to show how they were and how what his life was. And when they did show it, it did not change the judge on the sentence, but her family watching the video did mend with him and his family. So it was worth something maybe a little more intangible. But we think it's just so important for our clients to be seen for more than their worst moment on this earth, which is so much what we're dealing with all the time.
Yeah, I mean, we really see people in their worst, on their worst day. Getting back to sort of the idea of what our system can do to help institutionalize some of these reforms is, but also some of the problems is that a lot of the alternatives, again, like we said, don't include violent offenses. And Pedro was charged with something that was potentially a violent offense, but because the prosecutor amended the charge, he was able to get something called a first-time offender waiver, which doesn't change the fact of the conviction. He was convicted of a non-violent offense, ultimately. But he's still a convicted felon. But the problem is that so many people are ineligible that even though we have this sort of alternative, what it does is changes, essentially what it does is change someone who is a first-time offender in certain circumstances from going to jail. Even though they're still convicted. But as you can see here, in 2016, we had 709 cases of Snohomish County who were eligible for the first-time offender waiver, and only four were imposed.
So these alternatives just aren't being used when they are available, at least in our county. And then drug offender sentencing alternatives doses. That is really important. It's for people who have drug addiction and are willing to do drug treatment instead of going to prison. Or there's different ones. Some where you do go for a little bit, but you have a lesser prison sentence or jail sentence because of your treatment. But even those are really difficult. If you have a violent offense, you cannot get into it.
Even one in the distant past.
Right.
You're ineligible.
Ever. Yeah.
And then there's also another program called the Parent Offender Sentencing Alternative, which focuses on some of what you saw in the video of the goal of keeping families together. And what research has shown about keeping families together is that they are much less likely to reoffend when they're released if their family remains intact. The other thing is that research has shown that when a child loses their parent to incarceration, they are much more likely to become involved in the criminal justice system themselves. So if we can keep the parent out of prison and with the child, even if the parent has made a serious mistake, that is going to drastically reduce the chances that that pattern will continue. And it seems on some level a little counterintuitive, like why would we keep a kid, you know, in the family with a criminal? Are they just going in that person's ways? But the research has actually shown the opposite. But unfortunately, once again, this idea that they exclude such a huge number of offenses from eligibility for these programs.
And I just want to also bring up, we understand the need for the criminal justice system, but working with people who have been convicted or charged with crimes, even pretty serious crimes, when you work with them up close, they really are people, you know, with a great range of humanity. And so thinking that someone wouldn't be a good parent because they have a criminal charge or a criminal conviction is just not true. And also, many of our clients, they come from very difficult situations themselves. So at some point, you need to break that cycle, even if it doesn't feel right to you, because you're like, why are they getting away with this? Why would I give them a lesser offense? You know, at some point, you do need to say, we're going to invest in this person and stop this ongoing cycle with this family or this community or this population.
Another thing that has come up, which has led to increased prison sentences, so not only making people ineligible for the alternatives to avoid prison, but we have had a lot of recent legislation that has created, a lot of people are familiar with three strikes and two strikes laws. I'm going to skip over the sex offender sentencing alternative. We're going to do a lot on that on Thursday. life without the possibility of release, three strikes and two strikes laws, and we think about that as really serious things. And in fact, the crime of robbery in the second degree is included in that, and really that can just mean a shoplifting where you have a bit of a tug of war over whatever it is you're taking. So that is statutorily defined as robbery in the second degree, and you can strike out half life in prison without the possibility of parole for that situation. I actually recently had one. My client tried to snatch the purse and couldn't get the purse because of the strap, and then grabbed the cell phone out of her hand instead. And
that's a rob two.
Yep.
We had a woman in our office on a rob two who held up, while using drugs, held up a store, like a 7-Eleven or a gas station, with a curling iron. No weapon on her, but she was convicted and struck out on that offense and died in prison. And she was a pretty young woman. She died in her 40s, early 40s.
So when we think about who we're paying for life in prison, who we are using that theory of punishment that we want to keep them away from, they're so bad that we want to keep them, you know, locked up or away from us for forever. I mean, we're talking about the lady with the curling iron. The thing, and we'll just go through this kind of quickly, but there's the way in which prison sentences are determined. There are things called a sentencing score, which is based on your criminal history and also the seriousness of the offense. But for example, if you're convicted of violating a no contact order, this is actually a big one, that leads to huge prison sentences. And again, this is a non-violent situation in reality. It's as simple as a phone call. And if you've had a prior one, your score is tripled. And so I've had people who are looking at several years of prison on their first felony offense because they've had a prior misdemeanor, no contact order violation.
There's a professor at Seattle University, and she was looking at data that all of the violent offenses are actually going way down, but our prison sentences are going up, and our prison populations are going up. And her theory is that it's because of this. It's because the sentencing ranges are now so high, and they're tripling and doubling, so people are getting really long sentences that the judges have no discretion over.
And that brings us to the last one, enhancements. And if a gun or if a knife or anything else that is sort of deemed something that they call a deadly weapon is used in the commission of the offense, even if it's not actually, like, used on a person, just if the person happens to be carrying it, then there can be mandatory prison time, which a judge has no discretion over. And we're currently fighting that. But we didn't put this in because it's a longer video, but if you want to see at the end, we actually have a father and a son who are on their first offenses, have no criminal history whatsoever, are facing serious prison time because of these enhancements.
What's the difference between, I know what 3 versus 2 is. I'm familiar with the 3-strike law. I'm not.
Sex
two.
Offenses.
Oh, okay.
2 strikes out for sex.
Okay, thank you.
And again, we can talk about this a little bit more if you come to one of our later sessions, but sex offenses include a variety of broad range.
And enhancements are 3 years or 5 years for a gun, depending on what happens. So if you are doing something like burglaring a house and have a gun on you, or if you're doing something even lesser than that, and you have a gun, you will get those enhancements added on.
So we want to kind of choose. Go ahead.
I was just wondering what the barrier is for utilizing the waivers more. If 700 cases were available, how come only 4 successfully got that waiver?
So a couple things. One is prosecutor discretion or lack of discretion. They think, why would I want to give someone a break? They did something really bad. They were a cop.
So are they instituted by the prosecutor, though?
Well, it's statutorily available, but the prosecutor plays a huge role in whether or not the person actually...
If they don't agree, the judge will often not impose it unless the prosecutor agrees. Mm-hmm. And the prosecutors usually like to see somebody have to go get incarcerated somehow, which this can take that away.
Yeah, and that this is the retribution theory of punishment is, we're so used to thinking about, if you did the crime, you do the time. And this, in some circumstances, removes that, and people just don't like that in their gut, And one thing we'll get to in a second is if a judge opposes, he's an elected official. And if people think he's too soft on crime or she's too soft on crime, they're not going to vote for her. The other thing, though, and this is a little bit more of a nuanced thing, but we're going to talk about this tomorrow, mass incarceration, when someone is in custody and eligible for a first-time offender waiver, a lot of times by the time that we can adjudicate their case, or even if they were to plead guilty at their first opportunity, they have already served the time that they would be serving in the standard range sentence. And so the first-time offender waiver is of no benefit to them. So we want to sort of shift the discussion, unless there are other questions.
So you said that in Snohomish County, it's only been used 4 times. Do you see that as a... Do you have statistics broader than your county, or is...
We don't have statistics, but I'm pretty confident based on conversations, and Jennifer's an assistant director of our office, so she's sort of in a leadership role statewide in public defense, and I think...
The same barriers are in King County and Skagit County, at least in Washington, especially the bail one, whether it would even be something you would have to do by the time you could get out. You could have already served it, so the first offender waiver is in
Washington.
Sure.
With Pedro, if he has another offense and kills somebody because he's drunk, then the state is in trouble, right? I mean, the county. Because, I mean, if he would go out and hit somebody when he's drunk and kill somebody, then would that come back to haunt the prosecutor? Any of you guys?
No. Judges and prosecutors have immunity, which means if someone felt that way, they could not. They don't have standing to sue a judge or a prosecutor.
It could hurt an elected official.
Yes.
It could hurt an elected prosecutor and an elected judge.
Yeah, so I think that's the way in which there would be some risk involved for them personally. But
since we're talking again about Pedro, it's a dicey situation, I think, maybe even continuing, because I think Snohomish County is not a sanctuary county.
No, and in fact, Pedro is actually subject to a deportation order right now, and he's got an immigration attorney who's fighting it, but the first key step was to get him a criminal resolution to his case that didn't make him automatically deportable, but what they are not. However, someone from the jail, I don't know if it was because Pedro allegedly assaulted a police officer or something, called ICE from the jail, and ICE came, and so the judge released him after just the next morning, and ICE came and got him, and he spent 30 days in federal detention.
The double and triple scoring. I heard you said something about if somebody has a domestic violence conviction or something on their record. Then I don't sort of understand how that works. Are all of those say a little bit another sentence or two about what double and triple scoring means?
Sure. There's something called the Sentencing Reform Act. Is that what it is?
SRA.
And what it does is it enumerates every crime and how many points the person has, and then it's like a little grid, and the judge has to stay within, 3 to 5 years if you're an offender who has, one prior offense for an assault three or something like that. Now, if you have a prior, it's very complicated. You have to, when you're an attorney, you're looking all through the SRA trying to find out what can triple a score for someone, or what can add an enhancement. You have to look it up pretty much each time because it's quite complicated. But say, like the driving offenses I have to make up,
the
vehicle. That's what I'm thinking about.
Yeah.
Those can like triple. So your first time you're a one. If you have this, if you did something else, like you had an assault, you would be a two the next time. But if you did another vehicular type of crime, your score would triple, so it says times three. So now your points are five or a four, and then you go up the grid, and the judge has to sentence you to, between 5 and 6 years or something like that. It has no discretion to go any lower. So what's happened is there's been more and more tripling effect, where they now count some misdemeanors will add points to your felony score if you get a felony.
So like a misdemeanor vehicle prowling conviction will triple. That one isn't triple, but it does count as additional points against a vehicle theft. So a vehicle prowl.
It's like looking in a car with your flashlight.
Yeah. Yeah. And anything that sort of. So something that is really not very serious on its face can become very serious if accused again. So.
Okay, that's.
Sorry, did that explain it?
So
I'm curious, as these rules get more and more punitive, how much of that is led by or lobbied for by the for-profit prison?
Well, what we looked at and saw was there about 8% of prisons are for-profit, and the research we saw did not see that as a huge driver. As much of a driver would be the unions in the public prisons, that they need to, once you build a prison and you employ all these people, it just sort of, you gotta fill them, And I don't know if it's done intentionally or it's done.
I think there's a huge problem with for-profit prisons, but like what Jennifer said is they're not the main problem. The main problem is just sort of the prison machine is like, once you have the building, once you have the employees. No one wants to be the guy who did the reform so that less people are incarcerated and then they're laying off all these DOC workers. Because that's politically not helpful either. And those are public sector employees. So I'm not discounting the problem, but the research that we did just didn't bear that out in the way that I think some people have captured. So to kind of continue this conversation, in the beginning we talked about what sort of values or maybe lack of values have led to mass incarceration. I think one thing that we can all agree is that people suffering from mental illness serve more jail time than others, and I think we can easily find support for eliminating mentally ill people from our prisons. And there are a variety of ways we can do that, but I think the main way is to increase
treatment
options and discretion with law enforcement, where when we have someone who's crazy and like standing in the middle of the street screaming and talking about nonsense, instead of taking them to jail for obstructing traffic, they can take them to a mental hospital and have a professional evaluate them.
Mm-hmm. This is a large portion of our clients have mental health issues. And there's not a lot. Everyone agrees. The jail does not want, they say, we don't want people who are suffering from mental illness in our jail. The prosecutors sort of say, we don't want to prosecute mentally ill people.
I've had prosecutors say, well, let's see if this is actually a real mental illness. How would you know?
It takes a long time, too. You have to go before the judge. You have to get a competency evaluation. They have to get evaluated, they get sent to Western, they wait to get sent to Western, the whole time they're decompensating. It's really a terrible situation right now. But it is something that everyone is behind. It's just a matter now of getting the right structure and the right organization to have this happen.
But another problem we've seen sort of moving beyond, and not to discount this issue with mental health illness, but Snohomish County has actually eliminated all of their alternatives. So they used to have home detention available for some low-level offenders.
Electric home monitoring?
EHM electric home monitoring. That's like an ankle bracelet. And work release, where people would spend the night in the jail but be allowed to go to their job in the morning and then come back.
So they can keep their job, keep supporting their family, pay restitution to the victim. It's gone.
So why?
And who is behind that response?
Why is it gone?
A decision.
Was that
a political decision?
I think it's largely political. I mean, prosecutors and judges don't want to seem soft on crime, and also, Snohomish County has a public jail system, but I think that they would rather support the jobs for the people who monitor people.
No one is saying that out loud, so we're making some assumptions as public defenders, but what we do know is that these are no longer available, and that we're fighting for them, we're going to the different places to talk about them, and it just hasn't happened yet. We do have a new prosecutor coming in this year, so maybe there'll be some changes.
But what we know for sure is that our clients who 5 years ago were spending 30 days on home detention are now spending 30 days in jail.
Right.
One other great example is in Snohomish County is driving while licensed in the third degree. What driving while licensed suspended in the third degree is if you do not pay your speeding ticket, your license gets administratively suspended, and if you continue driving, that is a crime that you can go to jail for.
This is completely a crime of either poverty or being extremely disorganized.
Something that we can all do, that speeding ticket gets to the bottom of your pile or whatever, and then...
But to have 25% of the municipal, so this isn't county, it's the city, in jail for that is just... really showing that we're putting people who are in poverty.
We're putting the wrong people in jail. The other thing is, another 25% is people theft third degree, and this is a shoplifting scenario, under $500.
This is a misdemeanor theft, not a felony theft.
And the 2016 data is kind of staggering. 50% of the people charged with theft in the third degree were from one store. Jennifer and I actually can't remember. It was like
we were debating which store it was, but
and 36% was stealing alcohol. Like, and so many grocery stores keep like the booze at the front of the store. There's a total of $12,500 of loss for this store. But the cost of incarcerating these people is $200,000 in 2016.
So this is really small. This is a very small data sample, and it's Snohomish County, it's the city. But this does show that we need to look at the costs. What are the costs to what we're doing to people? What are the costs in money that the county, city, states are paying? And what is the reduction that we're getting for it? I think if we look at the next, it's just showing you the public dollars to incarcerate this person to save this store, $12,500. Maybe they should move the booze to the back or hire their own public security guard. But these are decisions that prosecutors are making to charge or police officers are making to book people into jail. And they are discretionary decisions.
Right. And so when we think about, the taxpayers are spending $200,000 to save a for-profit, very successful retail store, $12,000. So it's unfair to us too. So, this kind of tails on that, but this is a lot of people think, oh, most people are being incarcerated in our prison. Populations are rising exponentially because of drug crimes, and that's actually also not true.
Less than 10% of Washington prison inmates are there for a drug offense. That doesn't mean that what happened didn't have some drug involvement, but we're talking about specific drug crimes.
And then,
this is for us, 27% of the felony offenses that we have come in are a simple possession, so just possessing drugs, that's it. And we have 120 drug court slots and 40 are empty. And we are trying to get our clients in, and the prosecutors are really the gatekeeper for that.
Right, and so drug court is another sort of alternative to incarceration that we touched on earlier, but essentially the people enter into this program and essentially spend an average of about 18 months going to court regularly, once a week, then it kind of moves to twice a month, then once a month. They are monitored through, they go to therapeutic group treatment programs, but also and inpatient treatment if they need that, but also monitored by drug testing.
They also address education and housing. They can't provide housing, but they help give housing support and also just give goals for education and jobs.
But the idea is why isn't this program maxed out? And that again, I think, goes back to prosecutor discretion. They're the ones who decide whether or not you can go into drug court, and they do have a set of policies. But the problem is they don't abide by it on a case-by-case basis because they think, well, you technically meet the criteria, but I don't like the looks of that guy. Or, it's just something really
One other thing about drug court that I think is helpful to note, that in drug court, you can mess up. So somebody can be in drug court, be doing treatment for addiction, and they can have a relapse. And the judge, they'll come and talk to the judge, and the judge might give them 2 days in jail, but then they're back in. They're not convicted and sent off to prison. And I think that is something else that we need to address when addressing mass incarceration, is that people, with the suspended sentence or something, that if you're fighting addiction, you might fail. It might take you several times for this to work, and that we need to have a little more empathy and mercy for people who are struggling with these things and not expect, well, I gave you a break, and you blew it. You're gone. Because that is the mentality also we see a lot.
So some approaches that we think could help with all of these problems with either lack of alternatives or lack of access to alternatives is if we had more local community input. And for the example of drug court, one of the things that we've talked about is if there was instead of the prosecutor being the sole decider of who gets into drug court, if there was a panel that perhaps included members of the community, members of law enforcement professionals, and treatment providers, we would hope that maybe someone from our side would be in the mix, but can't hope too much.
Yeah.
Does that require action by the legislature to institute that sort of thing?
I think it wouldn't even have to go as high as the legislature. I think it could be a county, like talking to your county council members and talking to your elected prosecutor. And that really lobbying that way, because it's all, you know, internal policy base. So I think that's something we can do, you know, just talk to your local prosecutor and say, hey, this is what I want. This is my, you know, these are the values we want. More people, and this has been shown a way to help that.
Mm-hmm. Also, depoliticize prosecutors and judges. Mm-hmm. These are elected officials, and so things are going to happen. Not all of, if you give people alternatives to incarceration, some are going to fail. And I think that judges and prosecutors get worried about that, mm-hmm. you know, because one fail can ruin their election for a judge. Prosecutors win by being hard on crime. That's just what they do. Nobody's as enthralled with alternatives to incarceration as they are with having their neighborhoods safe and putting criminals away. So we think that would be something to be looked at.
And then also, though, drug court isn't free. Ultimately, it reduces costs to taxpayers because the cost of incarceration is so high, but we have to be willing as taxpayers to fund that and or at least tell our elected officials that we want the budget appropriated to support drug court away from the jails.
And while it's not free, it's probably less than incarcerating a person. I don't know. I haven't looked at those numbers. But it also is building something positive. It's really an amazing thing. And you could do this in your communities. It's asked to go to a drug court graduation. It's really wonderful. Somebody who's been through the whole process and is going to have their felony dismissed and has been using for 18 months and has gotten a job. They're usually, everyone is crying. The judge is thrilled. They're hugging. It's just a really positive thing, which you don't see very often in the criminal justice system.
Right. I mean, the newspapers aren't covering drug court graduation.
Yeah. But you, as community members, would be able to go to those. They're not closed, and we encourage you if you have time.
So I'm going to kind of move through a little bit more, but we've talked about a lot of things. We're going to talk a little bit more of the restorative justice, the fourth one down, and that's what Jennifer was talking about in the situation with the boyfriend who shot the girlfriend.
Yeah.
Or even the girl, yeah. We can also, we'll just kind of go through a quick little legislative background.
What we want to talk about here is that it actually has worked with youth. That is, at least locally for us, that if you do get behind reducing incarceration, that it can work. And we're just going to look here at this population of youth where this actually did work in Snohomish County.
And one of the reasons why it was initially focused on youth is because I think everyone feels a little bit more sympathetic towards children who make mistakes than adults. So in 1997, there was a shift in policy that basically resulted in a significant decrease in juvenile detention. And we'll talk about that policy in a second, but this was the average daily population of the juvenile detention center in Snohomish County in 2001, and you can see how it fell into 2016.
Yeah, it went between 90 and 100 to down to about 20 on a daily population. And this was because a bunch of people got together and really decided that this was going to be a focus to get our youth out of detention and find alternatives for them.
But
it did result in one problem.
Yes.
When looking at it, we got the population down, but what happened is it increased the impact, the diversity or the racial impact was terrible. The people that we had in custody were youths of color, and it wasn't until we really looked at the data and saw what was happening, we said, okay, we reduced the number of youth, but now we really need to figure out what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cultural community group that talked about this. We found out there was one diversion officer who was, for every 100 evaluations for diversion, wouldn't divert anyone who was of color. Maybe not intentionally, you know, implicit bias is just as strong, really. But this was addressed and is continuing to be addressed.
And so what we learned is you got to actually track the data. We would not have even known about this.
Yeah.
So while the overall population of the juvenile detention center decreased, essentially the proportion of minorities increased.
So we had that data, and then use tools and follow policies. That's kind of what we were talking about. When we have criteria that makes people eligible for a diversion or eligible for an alternative, we actually need to follow that criteria.
That diversion counselor should have had a checklist that was
Training on explicit and implicit bias. There's a lot of stuff out there. We won't go into it right now, but there's been there's a lot of trainings you can do, and those are really eye-opening for a lot of the juvenile justice folks.
And we talked about this, the advisory committee, and that we need to include prevention, intervention, and services. Services have to be funded. So
again, this is basically the data that impacted. Let's go through
some of this. We would love to talk to anybody who's interested in the juvenile system and some of the data that led to this.
But basically, the statutes changed and then the case law changed. And these are some of the, again, we're happy to talk about these cases, but it's kind of...
And the other nice thing with the juvenile justice, at least in Washington, is they explicitly said, we are looking at rehabilitation here. We're not looking at the other three theories of punishment.
Yeah.
They actually went out and made that admission.
So, just quickly, the Eighth Amendment is the prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. And what basically and this is not just Washington State, these are U.S. Supreme Court rulings, and really trended towards saying, when we are putting away children for this long, something they did as children, that is cruel and unusual punishment. Anyone wants to read a great book? If you have not, but basically, this is the takeaway from Brian Stevenson's book, is that when we are up close and with people who are facing these sort of challenges, then we have a lot of power in both understanding their situation and in influencing people who have the power to do something about it. And talking about these examples where people are treated unjustly can really influence the narrative. And then also just stay hopeful that we actually, seems like a staggering, and it is a staggering problem, but there's much that we can do and have to change that. And talk about what we're doing here, talking about uncomfortable things. So we just quickly want to do a little comparative analysis with Norway. So Norway's incarceration rate is just 75 per 100,000 people, which compared to the U.S. of 707 for every 100,000. That was taken from that graphic we saw at the beginning. When people in Norway leave prison, they stay out, has one of the lowest recidivism rates. Recidivism is sort of the fancy word for reoffense rates. 20%. The U.S. has one of the highest of 76.6%.
So the U.S. is just creating more criminals. And, you know, whereas Norway's trying to create positive citizens. They also rely on a concept called restorative justice. If you have John's book about peace, he's got a couple examples in there of restorative justice that are really powerful. What it's doing is trying to repair the harm caused by the crime rather than just punishing people.
So, welcome to Holden Village in Norway. this is actually a Norwegian prison that my mom and I visited a year ago in September. And this, you would never know it's a prison. It's a nice island. And you come on a boat, and they do have sort of more official insignia than the Lady of the Lake. And then you get there, and you eat in their dining hall. And you live in their chalet.
Oh, wow.
And it's family style, and inmates are all in plain clothing. The only reason why I don't have pictures of inmates, that was the only restriction I had, is I couldn't take pictures of the people who, and they don't call them inmates. What did they call them again? Like
community members.
Yeah, something like that. But it was really a change in vernacular, sort of changed. You know, even that small thing changes the way that both the people who are there at their own free will because they work there, or against their free will because they are sentenced there. But they all wear plain clothes. The only way you know who's who is by a badge that they wear. This is another house that they live in family style. It's usually 4 to 5 men per house. They cook most of their meals, and then the cafeteria is 4 people who... a lot of them are, have permission to work away from the island. They sign in, sign out. They don't even wear ankle bracelets. And this was the main hall, and the women are actually housed there.
This is not for low-level offenders. These are serious offenders.
Yeah, there were everyone here from, you know, assaults to sex offenses.
Murders?
I'm not sure there were any murder. Oh, yeah, there were.
Okay.
But it was based on not your offense, but on your behavior. And you might recognize their version of the pool hall and their music room. And they have had a band of people who resided there. And then this is their view from their music room. But they also do work there at this island. They both for their own sustainability and then making different wooden products. They raise chickens that they use. These are their resident llamas. This is where they grow much of their food in their greenhouse and also learning sort of sustainability skills. They make these picnic tables that they sell here so that the inmates can learn both sort of a practical skill and also earn money for their potential release. They also have a contract with this company, Voss, that distributes beverages. So it all sounds wonderful, but how do we do that here? And I think the one state that we know has sort of decided to try this is North Dakota. And you wouldn't think a deep red state like North Dakota would be on the forefront. But essentially, the head of the director of the president in North Dakota, and I think in many states, were invited to go to Norway and do sort of a cross-cultural examination of their systems. And the takeaway, and this was a woman who had not even thought about these things, and her takeaway was that we are actually hurting people. And that is sort of this idea that the recidivism rate is so high here, all we're doing is creating more crime by our standards. So they've implemented three things in North Dakota. One is called dynamic security, and that's the idea is if the person in charge of the prison or the people who supervise the offenders have sort of mutual understanding and respect, then everyone's safer. So they did things like, this may seem silly, but they, instead of having like non-existent like 1-inch foam mattresses, they gave people actual mattresses to sleep on. And they did things just to make people feel a little bit more dignified. And also the idea that if people are sleeping well, they're behaving better too, right? I think we know that somewhat in our own lives. And then they did... they implemented incarceration closer to home, so instead of sending people who may be offended in one part of the state to serve out their prison sentence in another part of the state, the goal was really to keep them in jails and prisons close to home so that they could continue to have family visits and family support and do what they could to keep those social supports intact, because that's really shown to reduce recidivism. And then finally, they've pretty much eliminated solitary confinement, which is, we could do a whole presentation on that, but that's really led to some of the worst aspects of our current prison system. So finally, the takeaway from North Dakota, which was maybe less of what we want people to focus on reforming and helping our friends and colleagues and loved ones in prison to be good neighbors when they get out. But really, in North Dakota, she just said, it's not a good investment. She's just practical. She's not liberal, she's just practical. So we don't know. We don't have any good data. They just started implementing this stuff in 2015, so we don't really have any good data yet about how that's working for North Dakota. And one of the criticisms from other states is saying, well, North Dakota, that's really homogenous population as compared to other other demographic or other geographic locations, so you know they might have an easier time than we do, and that's one of course the criticisms of the Norwegian system too. But at least they're trying. So that's it. any questions?
Well, just a comment. It sounds, you know, we want everyone to be altruistic and things, but you can reach people that are more conservative or have different views on a practical way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's how Governor Romney got.
Right.
We got universal health care in Mass. Because he said it's good for business.
Yeah.
And it was cheaper than having everyone go to the ER that didn't have insurance.
Well, and if you can do this, and then you can get the data, and then you can see that there are these other good benefits, not just this, but that people are coming out with less recidivism, getting jobs, then
it
you
could
can,
help.
You can use the practicality you should to...
Yeah, you wouldn't have to get into a... like. Philosophical discussion.
Right.
This works.
Right.
I don't know where this fits in, but you were doing the history, and I'm thinking a lot of the people that came to this country early on were basically convicted debtors or worse, and were given the option of coming here to, I suppose, be indentured servants or be in prison there. And so we have this kind of interesting background around prisons.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of times people just don't want to identify with that, even if it is part of their own history.
Just a comment that what all of us can do is to go to these boring county meetings and so on and kind of patrol how the budget is being tweaked.
Yeah.
I'm from Traverse City, Michigan, and I'm on a committee called BDDI, Before, During, and After Incarceration. We're trying to improve things at the jail. A lot of the problems just come down to money.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, when people are released from jail, they're released at 4 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
There's not public transportation then. It's terribly cold in the winter. The reason they're released at 4 a.m. is that that's when they have a person, an employee of the jail who's not otherwise busy. And almost all the criticisms we've had of what goes on at the jail really come down to money.
Mm-hmm.
And so something all of us can do is go to those meetings and listen to that.
Well, and it's hard to get the data. I mean, we had to collect this ourselves about like the thefts and the DWS3s. So also having your county or your, you know, asking them to collect data or make that available is important to see where you are choosing to spend money.
I'm just interested if you, at one point, one of your slides talked about community engagement and how we can all agree that mental illness, I think that's a really big problem. And everyone does say, yeah, we need to improve mental illness. And the gun debate says, I mean, all of that is tied into these mentally ill shouldn't have guns. But, you know, I'm from Minnesota, and just recently there have been two examples of one in Minneapolis where they were going to create this. They had a huge space open, and they were going to create kind of a transitional house, and they were going to have horse riding because there was a stable nearby, and they were going to try. And the community voted them down, not in my backyard. And so I really do wonder about that grassroots. I mean, everybody kind of, I mean, a lot of people, and I'm generalizing, I get that, but when it really comes down to my property values and my neighborhoods, believing that an organization can help people, and I don't know how you shift, again, that idea of empathy is really,
yeah,
I worry about that most, I think, in our country right now, because it doesn't seem like empathy is really...
And the other thing is, if it can't come through grassroots, it has to come through the courts. And actually, in our office, we had some attorneys who, on their own, did take to court. Maybe you can explain the true law decision better, but you know, if you can't get it through the people, you need someone protecting these people mentally, and you would hope it comes from the court if it doesn't come from the community.
The problem that we had is, so people who are mentally ill, because there's not enough like mental hospitals to take them to, but they were causing problems, right? You know, whether it's, you know, being, you know, what's going on on the sidewalk in front of your house. People are calling the police, like, someone come and get this guy. He's, you know,
right.
out of his mind. The hospitals won't take them. So they take them to the jail. And then what happens is these people are so deteriorated that they don't even really understand why they're there. And so then they have to have what's called a competency restoration. There's not enough beds available to restore the number of people that are booked into jail for mental illness, essentially. And so that's how these people end up spending so much time in custody waiting. So basically, we had a group of attorneys from our office sue the state and say, we don't care that there's not enough beds, find them. And they did, and they were successful. And there was a federal judge that said, you know, we can't have these people. However, so we won the court case, we still need basically it's kind of turned into that situation with, I don't know if it, the education in Washington State where that, where they found that there was, they needed to fund, education more, and then the state wasn't allocating the funds to fund the education more, and so they were held in contempt. We're basically in that posture right now legally, but I do think that, you know, some of it comes to having more compassion, and maybe you don't call the police when, you know, there's the, you know.
Or you call the police, and now we have some police who have embedded social workers. Maybe that social worker helps to assess what's going on and lead away from the jail and towards some other resolution.
Or maybe you have some sort of alternative
triage centers. We do have some triage centers in Snohomish County. So, but it's right. There's not a good solution right now.
Thanks, everyone.